We move now to the third and fourth words. Third and fourth commandments, as you're used to hearing it. Now, these are the only two positive commandments in the... Thank you. These are the only two positive commandments in the Decalogue. The others are, you shall not do something. And they take us to the heart of the family, and they provide a basic model for the way we should relate to God and to each other. The third word is addressed to adults in relation to their children and their servants. The fourth word is addressed to adults in relation to their aging parents. The values inculcated in the family by these two words provide the basis for all the positive values that are to inform human interaction. They direct us to recognize that in all we do, we are instruments of God's creative and redemptive action, and that everything is a gift to be accepted with gratitude and shared in love. If we do this, we'll be God's instruments in bringing about the reign, the kingdom, of God's love on earth. So let's look at the third word, Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 12 to 15. Observe the Sabbath day. Keep it holy, as Yahweh your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath to Yahweh your God. You shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, or your male or female slave, or your ox or your donkey, or any of your livestock, or the resident alien in your towns. So that your male and female slave may rest as well as you. Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and Yahweh your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, Yahweh your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. And we're familiar with it, but in its length, it's got a lot in there that you don't often get in the one little catechism line. You shall keep holy the Sabbath day. There's the text for the third word. Instead of verse 15, Exodus, see, Exodus has the Ten Commandments as well. This is one of the significant differences between the two. And there's a story in that as well, which we'll look at it another time. Exodus reads, when it gives its reason, here it says, remember you were a slave in the land of Egypt. It goes back to that. And so you mustn't treat your slaves. You must let them be resting as well as you. In Exodus, in 6 days, Yahweh made heaven and earth and the sea and all that is in them, but rested on the seventh day. Therefore Yahweh blessed the Sabbath day and consecrated it. You should be able by now, I think, to see that's a priestly text. That's a Deuteronomic text. They're very concerned with justice, and it's a lay text, if you like. This is a ritual text, so it goes back to the priestly document at the beginning of the book of Genesis. Here, I think it's more profound, really. It's giving a more profound reason for keeping the Sabbath holy. I shouldn't say more profound, but I think it's... What is the Sabbath? Well, one good place to go to is chapter 31 of the book of Exodus, 13 to 17, and I'll just read you this. You shall keep my Sabbaths, for this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, given in order that you may know that I, Yahweh, sanctify you. It's about holiness. You shall keep the Sabbath because it's holy for you. Everyone who profanes it shall be put to death. Whoever does any work on it shall be cut off from among the people. 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, holy to Yahweh. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall be put to death. So they rigorously see this as forming the community. Therefore the Israelites shall keep the Sabbath, observing the Sabbath throughout their generation as a perpetual covenant. It's a sign between me and the people of Israel that in 6 days Yahweh made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. That's not part of the Ten Commandments in the book of Exodus. It's another place, but it gives you a deeper or another way of seeing why this was so important. And you know how important it is to Judaism, keeping the family together without a temple, for heaven's sake, for 2,000 years. It's kept them. The Sabbath is their key practice, and it's insisted on and lived the way it was when I was a child as a Catholic. But it's not now. And maybe there's a problem in there. Maybe the work situation, and maybe the loosening up of all that. The home isn't as strong in teaching us our traditions. Maybe. Let's go on. The third word has powerful symbolic value. Positively, there's the command to work. You shall work on 6 days. We have the obligation and the privilege of continuing God's creative and redeeming work. There is, however, a danger that we'll think that everything depends on us. There's also the danger that the systems of authority that are basic to social organisation will appear absolute, and that those under authority will be treated as of lesser dignity than those who exercise authority. The seventh day, therefore, stands as a symbol of our need for God and of our equality before God. This day is to be set aside so that everyone may rest, may have the space to attend to God, to remember God's action, and to celebrate God's love. Now, none of that has been changed, by the way, so I think we have to find ways of regaining something of that Sabbath in our lives. Linked to the Christian Sunday, this is a word that Gentile Christians were not expected to observe. We don't keep the Sabbath day, the seventh day of the week, do we? The Seventh-day Adventists do, but Christians don't. Jesus is shown as putting the focus on love rather than on not working. In fact, he said, "My Father goes on working and so do I." That was his reason for continuing healing on the Sabbath. So he turned this commandment a bit. Ignatius of Antioch, early 2nd century, explains this. "We have seen how former adherents of the ancient customs have since attained to a new hope, so that they have been given up keeping the Sabbath and now order their lives by the Lord's Day, Dia Domenica, the Sunday, the day when life first dawned, thanks to him and his death. That death, though some deny it, is the very mystery which has moved us to become believers and endure tribulation to prove ourselves pupils of Jesus Christ, our sole teacher." So with Christianity came, the Jews kept the Sabbath as Jews, then on the first day of the week, which is the big radical difference, the day of the new creation became the day for Christians. Jews and Gentile Christians celebrated the Eucharist on the first day of the week, which starts at 6 p.m. on Saturday, of course. That's when the day begins in their way of counting. So we've gone back to that, really, since Vatican II, and we have a 6 o'clock Mass on Saturday night in our parish and a 6 o'clock one on Sunday. So that's the So we focus on the Sunday, which is not exactly the same as the Sabbath. We don't actually keep the Sabbath. But while that commandment has lapsed, the values in it have been kind of connected with the Sunday. And so I grew up, we weren't allowed to do certain work on Sundays, and so on and so on. But I suppose the suggestion is, I'm trying to talk to myself now out loud, oh dear, every day rolls into the other, doesn't it, for most of us? And Sunday is just as busy and just as pagan as every other day, unless we do something about it. So I don't know how we work all that out, but there are values in that that are worth contemplating, and perhaps we should all try and think how to spend that day, the Sunday, for us differently to keep it holy. But the economics of the country are really right against us, aren't they? And the sporting fields are too, so not that sport's a bad thing, but it's just that it's taken over. Okay, let's have a look at the fourth word, which reads, honour your father and your mother. And keep in mind what I said earlier, this is actually addressed to adults. It's basically, well, you can apply it, but it's addressed to adults, to honour our father and mother who are in a nursing home or whatever. Honour your father and your mother as Yahweh your God commanded you, so that your days may be long and that it may go well with you in the land that Yahweh your God is giving you. In the fourth commandment, another positive commandment, our attention moves from ourselves as parents having authority to ourselves as children owing obedience. To honour one's parents is to acknowledge that life is a gift. It's also to remember that the promises of God and the gift of the law come to us through them. To honour one's parents is to be ready to give them back in their need what they gave us in ours. So there's the two positive commandments of the law, and now we'll move to the words 5 to 7 in the Decalogue. The basic laws protecting life, marriage, and the right to whatever is need to sustain these can be found in ancient Near Eastern codes of law that predate Deuteronomy. There's nothing specifically Jewish about these three commandments. The Code of Ur-Nammu from Sumer, 2000 BC, contains these three commands. In fact, every culture does. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal. That's three basics. The Code of Eshnunna from Akkad in 1900 BC contains these in their code. The Code of Lipit-Ishta from Sumer in 1850 BC contains them. The Code of Hammurabi from Babylon, 1700 BC, holds these three. So we're dealing here with common material from any culture that's going to survive, and all the Middle East cultures had it. The code found in Deuteronomy goes beyond these three, we'll look at this in a moment, in 8 to 10, which we'll focus on shortly. In that, it is concerned with motivation and intention, not only actions. And we'll look at those in a But more importantly, the laws regulating social behaviour are founded on a relationship with Yahweh. So chapter 1, 2, 3 and 4 are before 5, 6 and 7, and that's the context in which you're supposed to do it. So the Decalogue provides this religious context for them, and you're supposed to read them in the light of that. It is for this reason that the code begins with the two words which regulate our behaviour in relation to God. Get that straight, clear, and then, in the light of that, these traditional values. So let's look at the fifth one first. Deuteronomy 5:16, 5:17, you shall not murder, is the way I've translated it. Ratzach is the Hebrew word. So, because it isn't straight, you shall not kill. What is forbidden is the illegal taking of life of a member of the community of Israel, even in revenge for a crime committed by that person. That's what this is directed against. It's not directed against taking life of an enemy. They did plenty of that. War, in other words. It's not against legal taking of life, because hundreds of commandments end up, we just read one of them. You'll be killed. You forfeit your life if you do certain things in the community. Radical, tribal, basic law. So, no, it's against murder. Ratzach. And that word is only used, it's not used for an ordinary word for killing. It's precise. This, I've tried to define it for you there. Let's look at the New Testament, Matthew 5. You have heard that it was said to those of ancient times, you shall not murder, meaning what I've just defined for you there. And whoever murders is liable to judgment. But I say to you, if you're angry with your brother and sister, you'll be liable to judgment. If you insult a brother or sister, you'll be liable to the council, Sanhedrin. And if you say, you fool, you'll be liable to the hell of fire, the Gehenna. Now, it's not meant to be progressive in any special sense, but Jesus is getting deeper into us. It's our attitudes that really matter. Again, you don't take it all literally. If someone said, oh, you're a fool, well, that doesn't mean you're going to hell. But it's dismissing other people. Anger, too, is a good thing, isn't it? Some anger. I'm in the habit, not always, but sometimes people come to confession and they say, oh, they were angry. And I say, well, stop bragging. I just to shake them a little bit, pleasantly, because anger is a thing we all need. It's a defence thing, and it's a feeling and not sinful. But if anger comes from because your own will has been put down and you didn't get what you wanted and you're angry and you do something about it, well, then you're into sin. But the feeling of defending yourself against unjust aggression is obviously healthy and needed. Jesus is saying, look, it's not just good enough to not murder, action. It's about your attitudes, the way you look at people, the way you respect them. All of these are critically important. The sixth commandment, you shall not commit adultery. So, life is critical, protection of life. Second thing, what about love? What about a love communion, the family, the essence of the family life? Can we interfere there and dislodge all that? No, you shall not commit adultery. Here's Leviticus, a bit longer. If a man commits adultery with the wife of his neighbour, both the adulterer and the adulteress shall be put to death. Leviticus chapter 20, verse 10. However, and ladies, you won't like this, keep in mind, if I'm a married man and you're a single woman and I have sexual intercourse with you, that's not adultery. Because no one's rights are being offended. She doesn't have rights. The males do. If a married woman, I'm talking about the Jewish practice, I'm not preaching your... You're all looking at me as though I'm giving you some kind of advice. But in their world, if a married woman has an affair with a single man, that's adultery. Because she has, the rights of her husband are being interfered with. So it's a bit tricky, it's a bit primal, it's a bit patriarchal, it's not very mature, and that's the commandment. That's how they define it. So we don't, but they did. We have to go deeper than that. Here's Jesus. You've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone, again, he's looking at it from the male point of view, everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. This is all pretty, I mean, who am I to be doing, but you've got to kind of interpret this, because it's pretty normal for people to think that feelings are sinful. I think that's never right. I think it's pretty normal for people to think that thoughts are sinful. That's never right. Thoughts are like blowflies in summer. And they come in and You don't chase the damn things. You'll be chasing the bloody thing all day. Maybe you've got better ways of catching flies than I have, but normally you just open and wait till it goes outside, or mosquitoes. When I went to Papua New Guinea the first time, I got no sleep the first night because there was one mosquito inside my net or something. And Jim said to me, look, if there's a mosquito inside your net, let it come, take a bit of blood, it goes off, it's happy all night, and you sleep all night. Otherwise, you kind of... the whole night becomes a... Well, people are like that with thoughts. I'll take the male point of view because I'm male. They look at someone and she looks very attractive. And thoughts occur to you. Good. You're a healthy male. And I presume it's the same from the female point of view. The thought isn't a problem. What's wrong is if I decide, the will is where we sin, I decide to do something about it, or I, you know, act in a way, or I speak in a way, or I do something in a way to, like David did with Bathsheba, you know, kind of arrange things in a way. So then I'm acting out of, I'm not just thinking or feeling, I'm actually attending, get it? I'm doing something, willing something, if not actually physically doing it. So we've got to be careful about all this, because thoughts and feelings, and if we worry about them, oh, I had that impure, this is usually the ones people worry about, had that impure thought. Well, what do you do when you worry about it? You just clung, and the whole of your brain becomes this impure thought for the rest of the day. Well, wouldn't it be better to just say, yeah, pretty good looking dish, really, and then get on with the next thought? Is that all right? God, if only yes. Well, there we are. There's nothing wrong with being human. And there's nothing wrong with noticing. It's what we do about it. Third, you shall, seventh commandment, you shall not steal. These are just one-liners. Whereas the first commandment was, you know, how many verses? About that long. The commandment against stealing is not understood as protecting possessions unjustly acquired. The prophets give us plenty on that. Or luxuries held in the face of deprivation and poverty. Go to some countries, and I don't want to exclude Australia, but we just had a tradition once of much more egalitarian. But you go to plenty of countries in this world and you've got luxury here and absolute poverty there. And that doesn't mean everyone get equally poor, but there's something going amiss there, clearly, because, well, if you've got possessions that you've acquired unjustly and you're keeping the thief away, well, the person who's living down the road who hasn't got any bread to give their kids has every right to steal your bread because it's not yours, you know, it's extra for you. The prophets accuse the rich of stealing from the poor again and again. Isaiah chapter 5, Amos chapter 4, 6 and 8, he's very much into this. So those of us who have more than we need are stealing. There's some wonderful stuff from the early fathers of the church on this that are very make me a little bit open. I've got a few things that I don't need in my way of clothes because I've had brothers who die. And you end up being landed with their overcoat or their... I think I've got three overcoats, not, you know, things here. Well, now I'm admitting it. I should give them away straight away, shouldn't I? But anyhow, and I've got... I don't know what else I've got, but I've got that many things. I only really need that many and... Yeah. So I think when I go home today, I'll do something about it. It's the advantage of giving lectures. These are the most straightforward and traditional commandments, these three. Shalt not murder, thou shalt not commit adultery, and thou shalt not steal. The you in each case is singular. Can't tell that in English. You shall, thou, is, if you like. The community is understood as a single, united body. These commands aim to protect a person's right to life, to marriage and to family, and to those simple, basic possessions without which they cannot live or rear a family with security and dignity. That's what they're about, and they're good. These laws were thought of as applying only within the community of Israel itself, and a person could forfeit these rights by behaviour judged to be against the community's interest. And now we go to the more subtle commandments, words 8 to 10. We observe now a remarkable moral perception that is special to Israel in the ancient world. You don't find the equivalents of these in these great codes, which are about external behaviour. Here you have, in the light of the religion of Israel, not only those first two commandments, which put the whole context, but now you have three commandments, which are much more subtle than action. In a society which depended greatly on the threat of capital punishment to maintain law and order, and it did, there's an obviously a close connection between the eighth and the fifth word. It's wrong to unjustly murder another person. It's also wrong to lie about others in court in such a way as to bring about their death. It's a more subtle form. I lie about you and say you did something which the law forbade. You are stoned or killed because of the law system. I've got rid of you, but I haven't actually directly murdered you. Well, the eighth commandment says, yes, you have. In a similar way, the ninth and tenth commandments are linked to the sixth and seventh commandment. Seeking to win over another person's wife can easily lead to adultery. So the actions, the plotting, the whatever programming, the subtle words, whatever it is that's attracting her, I'm using from the male perspective, away from him, these can easily lead to adultery, and giving into envy of another's possessions can easily lead to stealing. So can you see the connection between 8 and 5, 9 and 6 and 10 and 7? These are getting into attitudes rather than absolute, straight-out, provable behaviour. So we look at the eighth one, which reads, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbour. Jesus, you have heard that it was said of ancient times, you shall not swear falsely, but carry out the vows you have made to the Lord. You can see how in these chapters of the Beatitudes, the Ten Commandments are redone at a more deep level. But I say to you, said Jesus, don't swear at all. Swear, not meaning say bugger, but don't swear, meaning don't take an oath in God's name to support your statements. Speak truthfully. Don't bring God in to support you. That doesn't go against courts and things doing it, but there's occasions where we do it. But in general, this is what he's saying. Don't swear by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it's the footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it's the city of the great king. And don't swear by your head, for you cannot make one hair black or white. Well, I think you can, really, but some people do. Let your word be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything else comes from the evil one, said Jesus. So speak the truth because it's true. Brackets. This also requires a little bit of Jesuitry, has a little bit of care here, because you see, lying is saying something untrue to someone who has the right to know, primarily. Now, normally you don't have to lie, but sometimes you might have to. I'll take myself as a priest, for example. If someone came up to me and said, oh, did my wife go to you to confession this morning? Can you see the problems that could be? So the best thing to do is say, I never answer questions like that, and leave it like that, so you haven't said anything. But sometimes to make a statement like that, the person subtly picks up that she did, because if she didn't, you would have said no. Do you get what I mean? Mm-hmm. So not saying anything clear is equivalently saying no, rather, or whatever, or avoiding. And so sometimes, I don't remember ever having to do this, but in my mind, there would be times when I'd say, no, she didn't. When she did. Because I'm really saying, you've got no right to ask this question. So, because of the secrecy of the seal of confession and so on. So there'd be occasions when you have the right to to protect your knowledge from someone who has no business to know, and therefore you might deceive them purposely. I would say that's not lying, because lying is setting out to deceive, not to protect a value or a truth, but against curiosity or people who will misuse the information they get. It's a bit subtle. I'd have to be a bit more careful in saying it properly than that I have then. But there are occasions where silence can convey information that is dangerous and break confidentiality. The ninth and tenth words is only one verse, and that's this is the end up where you get the tricky part. They kind of go into one sentence, and we have to get 9 and 10 if we make all those early ones one. The Jews don't have to do this because one for them is, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt. So then our one becomes their two, and so on. And so this just becomes 10. Do you get it? The numbers will differ. And you shall not covet your neighbour's wife. And you shall not desire your neighbour's house or field or male or female slave or ox or donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbour. Romans 7, Paul says, if it hadn't been for the law, I would not have known sin. I would have not known what it is to covet if the law had not said, you shall not covet. These final three commandments move inward from the area of overt action to that of word and intention. Recognizing the importance of attitude and of the heart, Jesus takes this even further in his presentation of the Ten Commandments in the Sermon on the Mount. Most of the commandments are phrased negatively. They say what one is not to do and thus act as a protection against injustice, tracing the outer parameters within which the community is to live its life. As I said, the only two positive commandments in this summary of the Torah, and that's what it is, are the third and fourth, which are about family. To conclude, I'll just show you some texts from the New Testament where you'll see the Ten Commandments mentioned, the ten words. Mark 10:19, Matthew 19:17-19, and Luke 18:20. Jesus, to the rich young man, said, you know the commandments. And then he looks at not the first three, but the others. First, you shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not defraud, honour your father and mother. So he looks at not the ones relating to God, but the ones relating to the neighbour. Here in Romans 13:9-10, Paul says, the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and any other commandment are summed up in the words, love your neighbour as yourself. There's Paul's summary. Love your neighbour as you love yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbour. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. It's beautiful. And St. Augustine, who knew all of this, said, love and do what you will. The word love, of course, is not amare, meaning feel romantic about somebody. It's the word to love is the word to choose. Choose right. Choose the truth. Choose the good of the other person. And then whatever you do will be fine. So it's... Look at 1 Timothy 8:11. The law is laid down not for the innocent, but for the lawless and disobedient, for the godless and sinful. They're the first two commandments. For the unholy and profane, third commandment. For those who kill their father or mother, fourth commandment. For murderers, five. Fornicators, sodomites, six. Slave traders, seven. Stealing people, four. Liars and perjurers, eight, and whatever else is contrary to the sound teaching that conforms to the glorious gospel of the blessed God, which he entrusted to me. So in that first letter to Timothy, you've got him looking at the Ten Commandments in a positive light. And in James 2, 10 to 11, we read, "Whoever keeps the whole law but fails in one point has become accountable for all of it. For the one who said you shall not commit adultery also said you shall not murder. Now, if you do not commit adultery, but if you murder, you've become a transgressor of the law." In other words, every law is important to keep. And that concludes my treatment with you, a bit sporadic perhaps, of the 10 words.